Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
I am not always the grocery shopper in our family. In fact, I'm rarely the grocery shopper. I'm rarely allowed to be the grocery shopper. I don't tend to be too good at it. I buy stuff that I shouldn't. That's the problem. But anyway, so I was in the store the other day though, and I'm walking down the aisle and I couldn't help but notice that bags of chips, not the individual serving ones, regular like big size bags, they are way smaller than they used to be. That's just, though, part of something that we are seeing a lot of, products shrinking in size. Something that once upon a time was much bigger now for the same price. You know, the companies don't necessarily want to increase their prices because that's going to get your eye. That's going to make you go, I don't want to pay more. So we'll just give you less of it. Well, here's the twist on this. By doing this, the government is actually going to be able to make more taxes. You are going to be taxed more potentially, because there is less stuff that you're buying. Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. I know someone who can explain it to us, though. Sylvain Charlebois is a professor and the director of Agri-Food Analytics Lab, the food professor, we call him, from Dalhousie University. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.
All right, so this is a puzzling one, because normally things get smaller and maybe less expensive, then we pay less taxes. In this case, though, because of some, I don't know what we call it, an obscure law, but because of a law that's in place, smaller food products can lead to more taxes.
Absolutely. It's the shrinkflation double whammy for all of us, I guess. Well, Canada's Revenue Agency has strict rules when it comes to groceries and snacks. There is a line between the two, and it's all about quantities. And so when you go to the grocery store, most of the products you buy, well, according to Canada's Revenue Agency, it's all bulk. You buy a lot of it because you go home and you cook with it, or you do different things with the food products that you buy. Often a snack is a small portion. But right now, what's going on with shrinkflation is that some products are getting too small, so small that they're now taxed. Let me give you a couple of examples. Ice cream. So there are a few companies who've been selling containers of over 500 milliliters. But in recent months, we've seen a few companies like Häagen-Dazs, for example, Ben & Jerry's. Those are brands that a lot of people know. A lot of containers are below 500 milliliters, but that's CRA's threshold. That's the line between groceries and snacking. And so most containers now under Ben & Jerry's and Häagen-Dazs are now taxable. But you don't really realize until you get to the counter, and even if you don't look at your receipt carefully, you still won't notice, because some retailers, the way they structure their receipt, it's very awkward. Here in Halifax, bought a couple of jugs of Häagen-Dazs, and I actually had to look at coding, and at the bottom, I had to ask a customer service clerk to double check whether or not these products were taxable. Same for granola bars. Lots of boxes had 6 bars. Well, guess what? If you go below 6 bars, it becomes a snack, and therefore, you're taxed on them.
And so, let's use the ice cream as an example. So, let's say a company like one of those two decides we're going to reduce the size of this a little bit so that we don't have to increase the price, say 5 or 10%. So they actually reduce the size, so you get less for your money. Plus, by doing that, not only are you losing size, but you're paying 13% more potentially. So you're getting, as you say, the double whammy is that if you're on that borderline, you're getting hit twice.
The intent of shrinkflation essentially for manufacturers is to actually remain competitive, is to make sure that, you know, they keep the same price point. You're getting less, but you don't necessarily realize you're getting less. They're just trying to support a certain price point. But the tax man, well, both provincial and federal have other plans. And so that's why it's just a sneaky way to get money. And that money is not going to Galen Weston. It's not going to Sobeys or Metro. It's not going to Costco or Walmart. It's going to either Ottawa or Queen's Park.
this is not something that's new. Is it 2007 that this law came into place? 2007.
That's
so this
correct.
Is this
well, is, there's a memo. Every couple of years, there's a new memo that comes out, but that new rule dates back to 2007. So when I heard today that Ottawa is planning to give a grocery rebate, I thought, oh my goodness, that's going to make things worse. We're going to pour $2 billion in the economy. We're going to give money out to people. It's a cute name for an amplified GST credit, essentially. But it doesn't mean that people will spend that money on food, one thing. Secondly, it's likely going to make things worse instead of tackling the real problem, I think, and that's our fiscal regime with taxes within the supply chain and retail prices that are affecting consumers.
So, yeah, okay, and this is in the budget tomorrow, presumably. So if that money goes in, even if that money does follow, even if that money goes into groceries, if people are spending some of that on the items that we are talking about, that $2 billion goes right back into the government's pocket.
Exactly. You understood the entire scenario, Scott. And that's really the big problem. Now, I know you and I know why they're doing this is because they're politicizing this whole issue of food inflation. A check, when you get a check from the government, it's real. People will like that. But if you actually talk about reducing taxes or limiting taxes on food, well, that can't be as popular because people won't see that and they're not seeing it. But I certainly would encourage everyone to actually go to a grocery store, look at your receipt after you paid, and look at what was taxed and what was not. And you'll be surprised by the number of items that are actually taxed now. And that list is increasing just because of CRA's rules.
The other part about this that is so difficult is that not our tastes per se, but what was a snack, let's say, in 1990, we eat a lot more now. We have more calories. So a snack, by bringing the size down, we're having bigger portions, which even probably reduces what we would consider a snack. So we're like this whole thing. Is there has there ever been any thought? Have you ever heard anybody in the government say maybe it's time to revisit this because this just doesn't make any sense anymore because of portion sizes and everything else?
Well, it's invisible. And you know this, Scott, when something is invisible, nobody talks about it. And that's why I thought over the weekend, I thought of going to the grocery store with my wife and buy products that I was taxed on, bring them home, ask my daughter to film myself and put it on Twitter. And 300,000 views later, here we are.
Yeah. Well, again, I think you're right. I think that nobody really knows about this. And, you know, even if, and I know this won't happen because of what you just said, it's invisible, and I think the government would love to keep it that way. You know, how long ago was it that they made fast food places put the calories up on the menu so people could see that? What if we, on each of these items, said this much plus it's taxable at 13%, so the total is this? That would be more helpful. They'll never do it, but that would be helpful.
Oh, absolutely. But the bottom line, Scott, is that it's really confusing for everyone.
Sure, it is.
It's hard to know what's taxed, what not taxed. The bottom line, I think, if I would get the budget I want from Ottawa tomorrow, don't tax food unless it's served or there's processing on site, like at Subway, or if there's some people making pasta or cutting meat or whatever they're doing. You know, it's important. I don't think it's a good idea to tax food. That's the bottom line.
Do we know how much the government makes from food taxes in a year?
That's a good question. I have no idea, but I think it's important to know. And of course, on top of this, there's the carbon tax, and the carbon tax is impacting the entire supply chain. As of April 1st in Ontario, the carbon tax will go up to $65 a metric ton, which will make Canada the seventh country in the world we'll have the seventh highest carbon tax in the world starting April 1st.
Yeah, I did think that it was sort of ironic when, not that we're defending Galen Weston and the others, but when he was testifying about how he's greedy, it's like, well, you do, government people, you do realize that when you add carbon taxes, that also adds to the price of why food is so expensive. It's not just the grocers.
Exactly. So that's why it's, you can blame Galen Weston all you want, but you have to take some time to look at our fiscal regime. It's disgusting. It's really putting a lot of burden on everybody who works in the food industry, including farmers, processors, everybody. And they'll tell you it's really becoming more difficult to make sure that our food is affordable.
Sylvain Charlebois, always appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Most people are familiar with the promise, the vow that the federal government has made that by next year we're going to have 500,000 new immigrants in this country. And I think, I really do believe that most people are on board with the general concept. I think most Canadians are... Most Canadians favor this, whether it's 500,000 or whatever, but most Canadians, I believe, support the idea of immigration. We can quibble over whatever the number is, but many of us, most of us, we came here or our families came here through immigration. So I really do believe that most of us are on board. However, that said, and this is not a negative thing per se, but it's a challenging part of this. Statistics Canada last week said that the number of immigrants who came to Canada last year, the number surprised a lot of people, was over a million people, 1.05 million people, 96% of that international migration, but over a million people came to Canada last year. And the secondary part of that story, this is in the Toronto Star last week, many people who are coming to Canada seeking a new life, looking for new opportunities, are finding the cost and the challenges to do with costs shocking. We live in a very expensive country, certain parts more than others. And when you come here from places perhaps that aren't as wealthy, you've saved up your money, you've worked to come here, boy, it can be a shock. Sarah Wayland is senior project manager with the Hamilton Immigration Partnership Council. She joins us now. Sarah, thanks for doing this today.
Thanks for having me back, Scott.
Well, listen, for those who don't remember, we talked to Sarah a number of months ago about this idea of what to do when people come here, and there are challenges. Now we've seen, Sarah, these two stories that sort of collided at the same time last week that I think really do put a real focus on some of the challenges that people have when they come here. I'm sure in other places around the world, Canada sounds and is a really enticing place to come because of the opportunities. Does everybody, though, when they're coming here, do they know beforehand, are they told what is facing them with the challenges as far as costs and how difficult it can be at times?
Well, it's never been easier to communicate and to find out what the situation is somewhere before you arrive there. And there are a lot of informal networks and people talking to each other. That being said, the immigration process takes some time, and people may have put their name in the hopper, so to speak, and then waited a year or more. And by the time they arrive, the situation is different from what they had researched before they came. So it can be a bit of sticker shock, especially just quite lately, quite recently in Canada, for sure.
Well, and I mean, look, Hamilton is a prime place for this. I mean, we've been reading for months now, years now, about costs of homes to rent or to buy. I mean, it's, again, for some people, it's probably no big deal. But for other people, I imagine that those countries are not as wealthy as Canada to begin with. And you arrive with perhaps a certain amount of money saved up, and that can go very quickly.
You're absolutely right. I mean, immigrants come with all different amounts of money and from all walks of life. So, but money is often tight for newcomers, and they're more likely to enter the rental market for a while before buying a home. And we know that rental prices in particular have been increasing faster than wages. So that is a challenge for many people who are new to the country.
So what happens to many of these people, and again, the Star had a great piece, people can go and read it, but what happens to many of the people who do get here and are struggling because of the cost of everything?
Well, they may find themselves living in a difficult situation, not living in the kind of housing that they had hoped to be living in, or what we call vulnerable housing, because they are paying more than 30% or 40% of their income in rent or on a mortgage. And immigrants aren't the only people who are facing that.
Of course.
I mean, many Canadians, of course, are facing exactly that situation.
Is there are there the programs in place, whether public or private, volunteer or charity or government, are the programs in place sufficient to handle all this?
So a lot of the resources and supports that help newcomers are really not focused on housing. And I think this speaks to one of the stresses of our government structure, that we have the federal government making certain decisions and then the priorities fall to the provincial government, which has more to do with rental housing and market rental housing. And the provincial government right now is sitting on a surplus and not really investing into housing the way that it might be. And then we have municipal government kind of at the bottom, but on the front lines, having to deal with, situations of people who are precariously homeless and the like, but without having a lot of resources, a lot of means to generate revenue to deal with that.
Sarah, one of the questions, whenever we talk about immigration, there's always a bit of a risk because if anyone expresses any concern, sometimes they can be accused of being xenophobic or anti-immigrant or whatever else. But even within those people who work with the immigrant community, is there any discussion about, a million people last year, that's an awful lot of people to bring in all at once and try and become Canadian, to bring into society and be able to deal with all the challenges they have.
Well, I'm glad you asked me about that, because I think you have that 1 million sounds like a lot, but when you look at that number and break it down, actually most of that 1 million, more than 600,000, are temporary residents.
Okay.
And the most of them are actually international students. Say at least half of them are international students. So they're coming here, they're paying tuition to post-secondary colleges or universities in Canada, and they're getting a degree or a diploma here. And they're allowed to work while they're students, and they have fewer restrictions on working. So many of them are working part-time jobs in retail and in positions that often are going unfilled because they're, entry-level type positions that students take. So, and then there's temporary foreign workers. That's another big part of that 600,000. Temporary foreign workers are coming here because employers are looking for them. They are quite desperate to hire, and they're starting to go overseas to bring people in to work. And then a third area of that temporary residence, it would be Ukrainians. So in 2022, we saw a confluence of a lot of different things going on. The opening up of the economy and post-secondary, opening up of our borders to Ukrainians coming on a temporary basis. So more than 133,000 Ukrainians arrived in Canada in 2022, mostly on temporary visas that are last for 3 years. Mm. So when you say a million, it sounds like a lot, but 650,000 of that is all temporary residents. And then if you switch over to, so they're not technically immigrants. So they're migrants. They've migrated here, but on a temporary basis. They may decide to stay, but a lot of them ultimately will go back home again to their countries of origin. And then we have permanent residents, like immigration that was 400,000 last year. And a lot of them, probably 70% of them, were already living in Canada. And so when you say they immigrated in 2022, it was really more just a change of their status. So they came here, maybe as an international student, maybe as a temporary foreign worker, and then their status changed because they qualified to stay here permanently and they became a permanent resident. And so those people are not really putting additional pressure on housing markets and the like because they were already here. They're already in Canada. So a million, yeah, sounds like a lot.
It does.
When you break it
down
and
but
you look
right.
at these different streams and categories, then you start to understand that our population growth is, to say it stems from migration, yes, but it doesn't all stem from immigration, which would be more like permanent settlement here.
Sarah Wayland with the Hamilton Immigration Partnership Council. Really appreciate the time today. Thanks for clarifying this. Really appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome. Anytime.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Don Robertson joins me in the studio, the owner, operator, coach, general manager, president, fundraiser, bankroller of the Dundas Real McCoys, who are in the playoffs and about to host the Allen Cup in a few more weeks, and the guy who's behind Calm Choice Realty and looking very, very sharp today. You must have been out trying to sell a property or selling a property.
I was. It was a very frantic and busy day, and just when you don't have time for them, that's when they appear.
Well, so of course,
everything's good though.
That's well, you know what? It's when you say when you don't have time. When anytime you get. The fastest way to get someone to phone you, if you've been waiting for hours for someone to phone you, either get on another line or go sit on the toilet. And guaranteed the line is going to ring. And it's probably the same as, you know, someone you're waiting for someone to make an offer, the fastest way, probably just get busy with something else and they will then decide they have to get back.
And then you have to make time. And yeah? It's busy people get a lot of things done. And I'm finding that out very quickly. Don't even have time for toilet. I don't know what that's like.
All right, so I got a question for you. This is going to probably take the full hour to work through this, but I'm going to ask you this question to start on. I can't even remember what made me think of this the other day. There have been 24 coaches of the Toronto Maple Leafs since they last won a Stanley Cup. 24. How many can you name? Start naming the guys that you can think of that come to mind. I'll scratch them off here. When 24.
Pat Burns, Pat Quinn, Mike Babcock. Mike, who just retired from the NHL. Oh, boy, his son plays in the NHL. I'll come back to him.
Mike Murphy, you mean?
Yeah, Mike Murphy.
I'll give you Mike Murphy.
Yeah, okay. Red Kelly, George Armstrong. Going back a ways now, obviously Armstrong was Roger Nielsen twice.
Yep.
John Brophy.
Uh-huh, you're doing well.
Probably Punch Imlach.
Punch Imlach for 1 year. Back.
That would be tricky because he would have coached in 68 when they didn't win. No, he came back from 67, Buffalo.
67, and then he came back and did Buffalo, very briefly, yep.
Joe Crozier.
Yep, well, very good.
King Clancy.
King Clancy, very briefly, yes.
Yeah, he wasn't there very long. Red Kelly, who else was there for an abbreviated time?
No, you've done very well.
A friend of mine, Peter Horachuk.
Yep, I didn't know if you'd get that one. Yep, for sure.
You know Peter.
Yep. You're forgetting the current one. You can add him.
Oh, yeah, I guess Keefe.
Sheldon Keefe, yep.
And you know what? It'll probably get boring after this. I don't even know how many I have. How many am I missing?
We'll regroup. You're missing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 11. Well, we'll come back to this one. That's how difficult this is. That's how many guys have coached the Leafs.
Yeah, well, how'd you make out?
There were a bunch that I did not get. I don't even know. I didn't even count how many I got. There were a bunch, though, that I did not get. It's a tough one. If this is not the quiz question for the day, but people can make their notes here. And
I can't even remember who Peter Horachuk replaced because he became interim.
I'll give you a hint.
Go ahead.
No, he replaced a former Maple Leaf defenseman who won a Norris Trophy, not with the Leafs.
Yes, Randy Carlyle.
Randy Carlyle, yep. Yep.
Pat Maloney. Pat Mahoney.
Don Maloney?
Yes.
Yeah, you're doing really well.
The guy from Buffalo, or guy from Barrie, too, was a tough guy. Good kid out there.
Well,
let's come back.
We'll come back to that one. We'll see how you do. So, speaking of Toronto teams, Toronto hockey teams, the Toronto Six won the Isabel Cup on the weekend, which I don't know how many people watched. This is always a tricky one to know. I think it's tricky for the media to know what to do with the television stations to know what to do with, because you always hear people, this was the professional women's hockey. They won Isabel was the daughter of Lord Stanley. And so the championship trophy is named after her. And there's a couple things here. The semifinal game was played at Mattamy Gardens, the old Maple Leaf Gardens.
Third floor.
And according to reports, there were about 600 people there. And I don't know what you're, I know the argument always is, Don, that, well, if more coverage was given to it, more people would be there. But there has been a lot of coverage lately on TV of women's hockey. Games have been shown. And still, there wasn't anybody there, honestly. I don't know what the, like, is there an answer to this? Is this the market saying we're not interested? Is this something else? Is this, there's too much competition? If you paid female players $1 million salaries, would that make it credible, more credible, so that more people would want to come out and see them because now they're millionaire athletes? I don't know the answer.
They get an inordinate amount of publicity. I think they get more than a fair shake. It's a challenge. I think a lot of the media want to be politically correct and say it's pro hockey and it's women's pro hockey and we have to feature it. But at some point in time, you have to start taking a look at the crowds and the people. And, you know, I always watch people's feet. And if they're going to something or if they're coming to you or going away, it tells you an awful lot about what's going on in life. And so they would have had for their semifinal game about 200 more people than we would have had when we played the Wentworth Griffins at J.L. Greitmeyer on Friday night. And there wasn't any huge feature stories or TV interviews before that game. And but I think one of the ways to fix it is, and women's hockey is a great brand. I think it's, I think in a lot of cases like this, it gets set up for failure because, you know, the bar is pretty high and they're getting this exposure and they should be doing very well. And it's still really kind of a growing sport outside of Canada versus the U.S. and so on. I mean, that draws huge crowds, right? And
does well in the Olympics, for sure.
At the Olympics. But
and internationally, yep.
I think when you sink that kind of event into downtown Toronto, you would think, well, there's 3 or 4 million people there. They shouldn't have any trouble filling that arena.
Which we can get 4,000 people, let's say.
Yeah, it's 3 or 4,000 seat venue. I think Ryerson, the university team, plays there. It's not Ryerson anymore, whatever they call it this week, Metropolitan University. But I think it would be a lot more relevant if it was in Brantford. I think we've had this conversation before. Have it in venues the proper size. I think it would be more relevant in Owen Sound. And I'm picking these names of communities where it could be a really big deal in a small town versus not as big a deal as some people would like to see it in the city of Toronto. I mean, a lot of people have talked about taking your events to places like Toronto because the media is there. Well, if it's a really cool event, the media will come to you.
The thing that really I shook my head at as a result of this, so that was the semifinal game, and it didn't draw a ton of people, obviously, but it got a lot of attention. And so I thought, all right, well, maybe because it's been written about, it's been covered, maybe now it's the championship game, you'll get more people to come out. People will come out to watch a championship. Look, we've seen that with the Hamilton Bulldogs. You don't necessarily get a full house at First Ontario Center. You get into a championship game, you get 14,000 people. People will come for that. So what do? They play Toronto versus Minnesota, and the championship game is played at the Mullet Arena in Tempe, Arizona. Probably the worst hockey market in the entire continent of North America, with the argument being we want to expose this game to as many people as we can. Well, I can't understand the thinking here, Don, that you're trying to grow the game. Why would you not put more effort into growing it in places where there's a chance to grow it? Like, to have that championship in either Toronto or Minnesota would have made far more sense to me because you would have had a chance at a big crowd. And then the big crowd, they talk about it, the kids have come out, they've seen it, they go, oh, let's go see that again. The thinking behind this sometimes I just shake my head at and I say, it almost is like a self-defeating effort. Last year they played the final in Tampa. Now Tampa's become a pretty good hockey town, but I'm not sure that, again, that's the answer. To me, you grow these things by putting it where it can grow and nurture and become bigger and bigger and bigger. And when it finally becomes big enough, you start to spread it around other places. I shook my head. And if you looked at the arena yesterday, they did their best to make it look good by putting a bunch of the fans on one side between the blue lines. But when the cameras couldn't hide the other side, it was essentially completely empty.
the only thing I'd say about your argument, I get it. I mean, if you the NHL are trying to grow the game by putting a National Hockey League team in Arizona, and that's not going particularly well, and that's the National Hockey League.
Mm-hmm.
But your comments about the semifinal game being at the Mattamy Center and drawing 600 people, I kind of wonder about the argument. I mean, you're thinking, well, the Arizona, they have the championship game in a hockey hotbed. They have, like, I think Toronto is a Toronto Maple Leaf city.
Yes.
I don't think it's an NHL town. I think it's a Toronto Maple Leaf town. And that's it. Like, we've seen the OHL, which is pretty decent hockey and an absolutely wonderful league, fail in Toronto.
Mississauga, yeah, not good.
Brampton's Toronto, team is gone. Toronto St. Mike's. Oshawa's far enough away to be an island, kind of like London is, and Michael Andler's Bulldogs do well here. But it you do kind of shake your head. But when you say, when you want to expand the market, you certainly do need a base. And I was told a long time ago, you fish where the fish are. Like, don't try and find a new fishing hole when you know you can catch a bunch here.
Yeah, I just don't get it. I understand. I recognize, I see the challenges that are involved in trying to grow this sport. I mean, it's very obvious to see the challenges that are there. But I don't know that taking it somewhere where there is very limited interest in the sport. And I know people will say, oh, no, hockey's huge in Arizona. Sure. You know, and NASCAR is huge in Toronto. There is a fan base for sure, but it's not going to be the number one thing that's here. And hockey is not by any definition the number one thing there. You just, to me, you have a way better chance for the championship game if it's somewhere where hockey is important.
Well, I think that it probably drawn fairly well in Burlington.
Could have been.
Or Caledonia. Or, I mean, just talking about local centers here now. But this is not new. I mean, there were two women's pro leagues, and they were scrapping around and couldn't get along and couldn't form a league. And this may, in fact, be the result of all of that. But this has been a battle for women's pro hockey. This isn't new. This is a decade old now. Like this, I mean, they didn't start, this isn't a startup league from last week. It might be a new league, but, you know, they've been pushing and trying to create this thing for a long time. And probably you would know better than I, probably more than a decade.
So if the NHL, there's always been the talk that if the NHL would just get behind this and fund it and put big money behind it, that it would take off. That if every NHL team had, like with the WNBA, where you've got teams in the same city, that this thing would become really big, really fast. Do you buy that? If the Maple Leafs had the
marketing arm,
if there was a women's team in the whatever league, whatever you want to call it, that was playing under the, as you say, marketing business, whatever else, of the Toronto Maple Leafs, would it work? Would it become big?
I don't think the Toronto Maple Leafs believe it would. And the reason I kind of frame my response that way, and if a number of NHL teams thought that, they would probably get behind it and do it. You think they haven't done surveys to say, you know, we run 18 events at the Scotiabank Center, and they run all the NHL teams run 18 home games, which is giving you 36. You think they haven't done market studies to see how that would work? I would suggest they have, and if they thought it could grow and be profitable, they'd take a look at it, but they'd rather run concerts and monster truck shows.
But it doesn't have to be at the Leafs arena. Like, you could put it at the Coca-Cola arena, whatever, Rico's, whatever you call it now, down at the X, where the Marlies play, which is a much more, I think, appropriately sized arena for this early on to start with anyway and see where it goes. But again, I look at this and I go, so why wouldn't the Leafs have done this already? And you may have just given the answer, but if you want to push this, like, I don't think the Leafs, I know there's been a lot of talk that the NHL is waiting for there to be one women's league. We don't want to split our allegiances. No. We want one women's league and then we'll get behind it. But the Leafs don't have to wait for the NHL to be fully behind it. The Leafs could invest in a team. Montreal could invest in a team. The Rangers could. All these are private businesses. if they believe in it, they could invest in a team now.
Well, and the fact that they're not tells you all you need to know.
Well, that's what I wonder about. That's one of the things that I wonder about is why has that investment not been there? What is missing, or what is the belief? And maybe you're right. Maybe marketing has been done, and you know, I mean, one of the things I heard a long time ago was, well, what you have to get is young female hockey players to come to a game. And if they come, they'll love it, and they may well. And then they want to come back and bring their parents again. Well, that's for sure one strategy, but I don't know that you can run a league or make it profitable by simply saying our market audience, our target audience is 9-year-old girls and their mom or their dad. You need to have real fans that spread and people who want to come, whether they've got their kids or not.
Let me tell you where the challenge of that comes from. And I learned it from a former NHL president when we were doing the Stay Dog Stay campaign in Hamilton the year before they moved and ended up with 1,500 season tickets and was basically told our research will tell you, everybody said, we got to go to minor hockey. We got to go to Stony Creek, Dundas, Lambert, Ancaster. We got to go to minor hockey and get them to come. And I talked to my friend, and he said, that won't work. He said, it's been tried and tried and tried. And of course, I always want to know why. And before I asked the question, he gave me the answer. It's minor hockey parents, if they've got two kids playing hockey, spend 5 or 6 nights a week in the rink. And for a nice, quiet night out, they're not going to a hockey game. And so you would think that's where your base should be. But when you look at that analogy and think about it, so if you've got somebody that's got two girls playing for the Stony Creek Sabres or the Hawks or, you know, whatever, the last thing they want to do is, I mean, we had a group in Friday night from the Hawks girls team. And they brought a nice crowd. It was a different kind of an event for them. They also went to Sean and Ned's for pizza. I mean, they made it a nice night, but that was a big event for them to take on. They're not doing that on a regular basis.
But it's not just for their choice. Because also, if you are going after, if your target audience or one of your target audiences is minor hockey kids, don't forget there's a lot of nights when they've got their own games. So they can't come, even if they want to come, even if they love it. They've got their own stuff that is a conflict.
You can do it once, I think, is part of your point. You can do it once.
Make a special event.
Right. But you can't do it on a regular basis because they're already in the buildings, in their own rinks, playing, practicing. Maybe they got homework when they're not at the rinks. You see what I mean? Those young people have – kids have busy schedules, and mom and dad get wore out. And the last thing they want to do is go to – so what we did is we targeted volleyball teams, basketball teams, sports-minded teams that only get together in the high school gym or the church gym once a week and go out and have a beer and a plate of wings after that and say, why don't we get them to come? Because they have time. And the people that have the money and the time are people my age. Pardon me.
It's a real It's a real challenge. I mean, I a long time ago thought that something that could work in this city when they were talking about bringing a soccer team here. Now, the Forge have done well, certainly on the field. They've been very, very good. I thought that, you know, it's going to be a tough thing to compete with MLS soccer when you're right down the road from TFC, from Toronto FC. And, you know, the Forge had okay crowds. Would a professional women's soccer league do better or worse here? Because you've got some name recognition athletes from the women's league, from the national team, from the Olympics, and it would be different. And I don't know the answer. Maybe they would draw 2,000 people. Maybe they would draw 500 people. I don't know. But women's sports just becomes this ongoing challenge where you look and you say, why is it so difficult so often? And telling people that you should go to a game because is not really a good sales pitch.
It won't work.
It won't. It's not. You can't guilt people into going.
There's a pretty good, from what I understand, women's. And I don't to call it rec league would be unfair. An elite premium league that people like Laura Fortino play in. And I mean, that's been going on in Mississauga and
much of the PHPA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, how do they draw?
It's always tough.
Like, and that's the best women's hockey, and it's pretty competitive. It's good. But it's just, I think they fall into that trap like I suggested that the OHL teams do. They're in Toronto.
I mean, part of it may be that with Canada versus the States in Olympic women's hockey, the teams matter. Forget the players for a second, but the sweater matters. And it may have something to do with, honestly, for the average person, would they know what the name of the Minnesota team was? First of all, would they know the name of the Toronto team, the Toronto Six? I don't know. But would they know the name of the Minnesota team that Toronto was playing against in the Isabel Cup final? I would bet 90% or more, 95% of people would have no idea. So you've got the problem of the team itself has no resonance. It's got no history. So maybe by winning a championship, the Toronto Six get enough attention that now people become a little more familiar with the name. And then when you talk about it, maybe that then becomes something that carries a little more oomph and a little more weight and a little more credibility for next time. I don't know. We're going to see.
Well, I mean, we talk about this, I guess, every 2 or 4 years. Olympics.
Yeah.
And I watch all kinds of Olympic sports and everything else. And I never, ever crosses my mind when Mac's having a track meet to go down and watch a couple events that I really enjoy in the Olympics. I'll sit down and I'll enjoy it at the Olympic Games and say, these athletes are unbelievable. Well, locally, there's some unbelievable athletes.
Some of the same people are here competing that would be there, but
does it ever cross my mind to say, I really want to go down and watch that event, and I don't think I'm in a minority.
We got to go, but I'll tell you a story. So many years ago, I mean, it's got to be 10 or 12 or more years ago now, I was speaking to a class at McMaster. I'd been invited I knew the professor, and it was mostly the vast majority were women who, it was I don't know what kind of program it was, but many of them were, it was a sports related program. And I was talking about stuff. And one of the things was, all right, so we were asking this very question, even back then, why is it so difficult for women's sports to draw big audiences? And several of the people put up their hand and said to me, well, it's sexism, that men don't come out and support women's sports. And I was like, okay, that may be. I'm not going to say that's not got anything to do with it. But then after a few of them had spoken, I said, okay, and remember, this is largely a female audience. I said, by show of hands, how many of you were at Mac's women's basketball game 2 days ago? And like 3 hands went up. I was like, well, you're saying that it's sexism that guys don't come to women's sports games, but this is mostly an audience of women, and you didn't go to your own team's game. So whose fault is that then? Like, it's not about that it's men's fault. It's not about that it's women's fault. It's not about faulting. The question is, how do you get over the hump to say, not that you should go because you feel some sort of requirement as a woman or guilt as a man that you should support this? How do you get to the point where you get people who say, I can't wait to go? Like we see with the NBA or the NHL or the NFL or whatever else. How do you cross that line to get people to say, that's something I absolutely want to clear out time on my schedule to go to? And I don't know the answer to that.
And I don't think many do.
Well, clearly not. But I'll tell you one way not to do it. You don't stick your championship game in the worst hockey market in North America. That to me was just like, what are you doing? Anywhere but Arizona. I mean, have you watched where the Coyotes are playing? And they don't even fill that arena. And it's the smallest barn in the entire league. What are you doing putting it there? Anywhere but there. I mean, put it in Kuwait and you'd probably have a better chance. I mean, it's just like, I was like, okay, this is the worst idea I've ever heard.
Was it on TSN or Sportsnet?
It was on one of them.
Yeah.
It was on one of them anyway.
I don't know who's financing it, but they must have a lot of cash.
Well, They've got some money, I guess, but it was like, boy, you know what? As you say, go where, if you're going to fish, go where the fish are. And that it's a good line that you use, because it just, it seems to me that you would have been, they would have been, with the coverage they had received in the semifinals and a beginning of a bit of an interest, you would have been better off just to say, put it in Toronto or say Minnesota, where women's hockey is huge. Don, the I don't know if you saw this video today. I think it was last week or the week before. We were talking about basketball officials and, you know, being, doing some stuff that you just shake your head at. So there was a guy in the exhibition baseball, spring training baseball today. The pitch before, the ball had been hit into the crowd, been a foul ball or something, and so the umpire had thrown the ball back to the pitcher. Some umpires throw the ball back to the pitcher, some give it to the catcher to throw back to the pitcher. He had thrown the ball back to the pitcher. Next ball goes out. Catcher puts his glove back over his shoulder, palm up, so the umpire can put it in. And then, clearly, not even looking at the umpire, thinks, oh, he throws it back to the pitcher, so he pulls his glove down back to its normal spot. Well, as he put it up, the umpire went to throw the, like, put the ball into his glove. The catcher, not even looking at the umpire, had taken his glove away, so the umpire basically throws the ball into the ground, ejects the catcher for apparently trying to show him up.
Oh, and really?
You can go find it online. It's the absolutely most ridiculous thing, and I'm coming back to this one because it seems to me I don't have an issue with officials who make a call that you disagree with. Officials are human. They're going to miss penalties. They're going to get penalties. They're going to, it's subjective in some cases. Their decision on what's a penalty and yours and mine may differ. I'm not going to argue with an official on penalties. But my goodness, when you do stuff that just flexes your muscles for the sake of flexing your muscles, this came up in the Raptors game a few weeks ago, and this one, what do you do if you're a league? What do you do to try and rein this in? Because the one thing I can absolutely say for absolute certainty, with absolute certainty, is that there, we were talking about fans coming to games. There is not a single fan that is coming to any game to watch an umpire ump.
No, they're not. Not anymore.
But what do you do if you've got someone as a league? Do you rein this in, or is that taking away the ability to control the game and show the players who's boss? And like, are you removing? Is it like taking a teacher's ability to discipline a student away if you tell the guy to pull it back?
Well, based on your description of what happened, it sounds like it was pretty bizarre and very petty.
It was very petty
to do that, but. Being a former official, I would suggest that there may be a bit more to what actually happened than the moving of the glove and what might have been said. And it might have been, well, if you're not going to give me the ball, why don't you go ahead and throw it back? You like doing it anyway. Like, I don't know what else went on, and I just can't believe in Major League Baseball you're heaving a catcher because he put his glove down and made you look a little bit stupid. There has to be... I would hope more to it. I'll give
But even if there was, even if we didn't hear the conversation, and even if they had a conversation that not one person in the audience saw, at that point, is it worth throwing the guy out? Because you've not embarrassed him. Nobody heard what you said when you were facing forward behind a mask.
I tried to defend him a little bit there.
I just
the best I can, but I don't know, and not seeing it, I trust your description of it. It does sound a little bit petty, but. You know, for all I know that all of the umpires have said, look, we're tightening all this stuff up. Maybe the supervisor was in the room. So, you know, if they're going to start showing you up, you get rid of them right away. Set the tone for the year. I don't know. Still trying to defend them, but it's tough.
I think that officials have taken – I was hearing a discussion about this with some people the other day. I was somewhere. I don't remember. It came up. And the comment was, and I agree with it, that officials with HGTV now, 4K, 5K, 8K, whatever, super slow-mo, all the technology, officials have been put into a no-win position because they are making a call split second and we get to slow it down and zoom in and all this stuff. It's an impossible position for officials to be in. I don't know that stuff like this helps them. Because now you just get people who look at them and go, oh, well, they're power-hungry maniacs, when 99% of them are not. I just don't know. I don't know that you want to do anything that makes your job harder or brings more spotlight onto the already difficult job you have.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But it's, I mean, it was, like I say, there has to be more to this. I don't know. It's an exhibition game in presumably Florida.
Yes.
Not the Grapefruit League, or Grapefruit League, not the
Cactus,
the Cactus League. But there has to be more to it. Like, what umpire would need the aggravation of doing that? That's how I look at things. Like, why would you bother? Unless he was already ticked at something.
Yeah, I've come to the conclusion, as I said a moment ago, that officials are in a no-win position more often than not now, because their job has become impossibly difficult, and there are so many rules. A while back, I found a copy of the, or I saw it online, I don't know where it was, the 1967 NHL rulebook. I had smaller brochures when I like bought a product for, you know, that needed instructions on how to load or something. Like, it was like, it might have been 20 pages thick. Now the NHL rulebook is enormous.
Yep.
And same with every other league as well. The rules they have, all the various permutations and combinations. I just don't know that any official should be making their job harder or the job of all their colleagues harder by doing stuff that makes them look bad. That should be, to me, that's front of mind.
Well, they should try and make it simpler, right?
But beyond that, your behavior should be front of mind. I'm not going to do something that makes me look like I'm flexing my muscles, knowing this is going to make everyone else's job harder, because now people are going to be more paying attention.
Yeah.
Anyway, let me take a break. You can go watch that one online, by the way. You will watch it, and you decide if the guy should have been tossed or, you know, maybe the ump should have been tossed. I'm sure he'll be spoken to, but it probably won't lead to anything. It'll just make life for his colleagues more difficult, I believe.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Earlier in the show, we were going through all the Leafs coaches since they last won in 1967. Don Robertson already got King Clancy, Red Kelly, Roger Nielsen, Punch Imlach, Joe Crozier, Dan Maloney, John Brophy, George Armstrong, Pat Burns, Mike Murphy, Pat Quinn, Randy Carlyle, Peter Horacek, Mike Babcock, and Sheldon Keefe. That's very impressive. You've had some time now. You got any others?
Well, I said Jim Gregory. I don't know if he went behind
Never
the bench
was,
or not.
Nope.
He was the GM.
Nope.
Dick Duff.
Yeah, that's another one.
Really?
Yep.
That's the era. I said another name, too, when we were off the
you
air.
You did. Yeah, I'll give it to you because you said it off the air. Floyd Smith. That's another one. Yep. Yeah. So,
Well, I got dinosaur poop on my shoes for knowing all those guys.
Oh, no, that's very impressive. You only have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 left. I'll give you a hint on one of them. One of them was the NHL's first ever assistant coach. He coached with Fred Shearer with the Philadelphia Flyers. First ever assistant coach before he got hired full-time by the Leafs. He predated, he was two before John Brophy. Mike Nicoluk.
Yeah.
Mike Nicoluk.
Well, no, I should have known that one.
Doug Carpenter.
Yep.
A guy whose son I used to play hockey with, Tom Watt. He was a far better hockey player than I was.
And I know Tom Watt, too. That's disgraceful.
A guy who is still coaching in the league. He's been in Winnipeg, and he's now in Florida.
Oh, sure. Paul Maurice.
Yep, Paul Maurice. And a guy who played for the Washington Capitals, I believe, and he coached some other places as well. He had a similar name person who was an assistant coach with the Hamilton Bulldogs for years. I can't remember where else this guy coached off the top of my head. Ron Wilson.
Oh, right, yes.
Ron Wilson.
Yes.
And your golf course where you often play is near another golf course.
So I play it.
Copetown. Across the street is Beverly.
Yeah.
Nick Beverly, very briefly. How are people doing at home here? Did anyone get these? And a guy, I had to look this guy up because the first guy after the championship, after Punch Imlach left, John McLennan. Do you even remember John McLennan?
I don't remember them. Was he there 15 minutes?
No, apparently he was there for a while. There you go. 24 coaches of the Leafs.
And counting.
And, well, we'll see. We'll see how they do. If they don't win a round this year, it'll be end counting because there'll probably be someone else in there for Sheldon Keefe. We will see. All right, let me give you the quiz question. Last chance on this one today. That was not the quiz question. That was Don's quiz question because every week Don comes in and he's just chomping at the bit to give the answer. Thought I'd give him one that he could do. He did very well. I'm very impressed. You had about 18 or 19 of those. That's very impressive. Way more than I would have got. Don, before you go, Real McCoys and Allen Cup Hockey, what's going on?
We lost in overtime to the Hamilton Steelers last night, which puts them into the Robertson Cup Finals with us and gave them a berth in the Allen Cup, along with Innisfil Eagles and Clarenville Caribous, which will be announced tomorrow.
Okay.
Other than today. And then we're going to start the finals. And I thought we were going to start them Friday night, but it appears somebody may have J.L. Greitmeier booked on a traditional Friday night that Dundas Real McCoys always plays. So don't know when they're going to start, but we ended up on top of the heap. So soon.
There you go. Soon. We'll let you know. Thanks for coming in, by the way. Always appreciate it.
It was fun.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.